Welcome to the Geekcentric Podcast, and welcome to our spoiler-free review for Marvel Studios' The Fantastic Four, First Steps. We will face this together. We will fight it together as a family. I'm Jayla, but you can call me Justin, and if you're joining us for the first time, well, we are Geekcentric, a podcast covering the world of movies, TV shows, toys, collectibles, gaming, and all things geek-centric. Joining me today for this fantastic spoiler-free review are two fantastic dudes. One has the ability to stretch where it matters, and the other knows how to light things on fire very quickly. It's up to you to decide who's who. Nate Shelton, Darcy Hudson, welcome, welcome.
Yeah, I like to, maybe I find a way to stretch my wallet as much as possible. that's maybe, or I stretch the reality of why I might need to buy something or own something. But yeah, no, maybe that's my superpower.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about how I'd like to light things on fire easy all the time. More easily all the time. I can't speak right now. Jesus. I think that's not my power.
Yeah, off to a great start. I'm very excited to be talking to you guys about this film. We are stoked that we were able to see it early, thanks to our friends at Disney Studios Canada. I did want to quickly ask you guys, before we got into discussing this film, we obviously know that this isn't our first rodeo or introduction to The Fantastic Four. There are other films that have not been well received. But hey, you know what? We like a good bad movie every so often. Was there one of those Fantastic Four movies that you really, really enjoyed before we got this MCU proper version of The Fantastic Four?
I was always a fan of that first Fantastic Four movie with Ian Gruffold and Chris Evans and all that, and Jessica Alba. I mean, it was cheesy, but it was of that era of superhero movies when they were cheesy, and that was just you expected that and you went with it, and I don't know, I had a lot of fun with it. Other than that, not so much. I will say the more recent Fantastic Four iteration had my hopes up for the darker tones that it could have taken the characters. I talked about some of the potential reads out there and how I liked that from the trailers. Miles Teller's read was going to go to some dark places. What we got in the final version of that film was, I mean, not the best. So yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, because it almost feels like these movies have followed the trajectory of what I think as Marvel fans we kind of have wanted, you know, that those early days, the 2005 stuff, you know, getting to see the goofiness of how Michael Chiklis looked in that costume, but then he had that heart, right? And he did such a good job with that role. And Chris Evans was so funny, and Jessica Alba's so fantastic in that movie as well. And I just think it's like, then we go into the darker area where it's like everyone wants Nolan's Batman. Everyone wants the dark superhero movies, and it clearly did not work. And now we're here, and I'm so happy that we're back to the comic book of it all.
I agree with you, Darcy. I think the first one was very comic booky, but it was also very nostalgic of the superhero movies or comic book movies of the time, where it was super flashy. But with the Fantastic Four and the sort of camp that kind of surrounds the family, they nailed that in that first one, that sort of charm, if you will. And then two just felt a little excessive. But the one from Josh Trank, I was very excited for. Very much on the same vibes that you were going with in the sense of the darker tones. And as you said, Nate, like the Nolan vibes, if you will, like nullifying the Fantastic Four. But yeah, that was a mess of a production, and it shows in the final product. It's unfortunate, because that filmmaker is very talented, and it's a shame that movie didn't get to realize. But yeah, I would agree with you too. I think the first one was probably the closest, even though I was seeing today that obviously reviews are out right now for The Fantastic Four, First Steps, and already on Rotten Tomatoes, it's at 88%, which it has surpassed all of the other iterations of this film that have been at like 16, 20, and then 9% for Josh Trank's the latest, the last entry into the Fantastic Four. So, you know, good on Marvel. But you know what? Hey, we're here. We're here to add to the conversation. We are stoked. We are going to be doing this spoiler free. Let's get into talking about this movie. Let's get the synopsis out of the way. Set against the vibrant backdrop of a 1960s-inspired retro-futuristic world, Marvel Studios' The Fantastic Four First Steps introduces Marvel's first family. Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic, Sue Storm, Invisible Woman, Johnny Storm, Human Torch, and Ben Grimm, The Thing, as they face their most daunting challenge yet. This film stars Pedro Pascal, who plays Reed Richards, Vanessa Kirby, who plays Sue Storm, Joseph Quinn, who plays Johnny Storm, and Eben Moss Bacharach, who plays Ben Grimm. We also have Ralph Ineson, Julia Garner, Paul Walter Hauser, Natasha Lyonne, and Sarah Niles. Marvel Studios' Fantastic Four First Steps hits theaters July 25th, 2025. So this Friday, this film is directed by Matt Shakman, who you will know and love from WandaVision, who definitely brought some of that 60s flair. And I think we should start with that 60s flair. Let's talk about the look and feel, because so much of this movie is going to be celebrated for that, right? There's this sense of like creative freedom that seems to be kind of running rampant in this film, because it's, you know, Earth 828. So it is a alternate universe from our main MCU timeline. So there's a lot of freedom here to kind of lean into the Kirby, the Jack Kirby aesthetic, while also mixing in a bit of that Jetson vibe, as well as just throwing in, like I said, like that WandaVision sparkle that kind of holds it all together with that nostalgia. So I was very much immersed in this aesthetic. How did you guys feel about the look and feel of this film? Darcy, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. From minute one, you're dropped into like just a recurring thing that is this nighttime talk show, and it feels like a late show with that's happening, or Johnny Carlson, something like that. It nails the vibe from minute one, and it doesn't miss a beat in trying to continue nailing that vibe. Like, it is just looks so of an era that we have never seen before, and it is so refreshing to see a consistent idea like that brought to life so well throughout this film.
Yeah, I think you were touching upon it, Justin. Like, what Matt Shakman brought into this movie was, you know, from some of those episodes of WandaVision, but he doesn't just bring it to a couple episodes. He brings it to an entire new universe. And I think that helps, as you said, to set the movie apart from our traditional, you know, 1999-99 MCU films, and then gives us the tone to understand that, like, we can have flying cars in the 60s next to our bubble CRT looking screens, along with like golden age villains like Mole Man, Red Ghost and his super apes or whatever, and Giganto. And at no point in time was I wondering how any of it works, or how, more importantly, how any of it ties into, you know, our reality. It's a reality all on its own. And I think that's what's so refreshing about the entire tone and look and feel of the movie.
Yeah, it's so vibrant. It's heavily stylized. There's such a great sense on like practical elements. Like, the car's actually a car, right? You know, it's not a CGI car. A lot of the sets were built for the purpose of this film. You know, there's obviously CGI in places, which is noticeable, and we can talk about that. But for the most part, it was about giving some tactile nature to these sets that do make it feel lived in, and there is this like sort of surreal quality to it, where Earth 828 feels lived in, but it almost feels like a dream at the same time, because it has like this timeless quality. It's not bound by like its real world logic, like you were saying, and I think that works for it. And I think, you know, having this like balance between like analog charm and like 60s sci-fi, like you said, flying cars, colorful control rooms and labs, and the cityscape just looks, you know, sort of changed and morphed from this futuristic world. It just all works to feel very cohesive, and I really appreciated the attention to detail to make it feel that way and not feel so artificial.
Yeah, and I think with a world that is so clean and very bright, I think you do run that risk, right, of it feeling like too fresh or too clean. And I think they did a really good job of balancing that out. And I think the costumes, the use of like hand painted signs, the idea of using like records or tapes for like storing information or playback, I just think it made me want to live in that version of New York. I wanted to live in their headquarters, which is very Avengers Tower-esque, right? And I think, you know, even if they have a gorgeous smart home with a fantastic kitchen that doesn't always work, it was just a place like I there wasn't a single moment in the movie where I was like, oh, this doesn't feel inviting, like I especially in and around the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, Justin, you mentioned at the top the Jetsons vibe, and I feel like that's the look and feel that is so nostalgic and comforting to us, is something that we've grown up watching. Everyone has seen Jetsons at least once or twice. So like the looks they bring and the crisp, sharp lines, the front, the cleanliness is all just this retro idea of what the future would be. And again, it's nailed so well in this movie.
I guarantee you whoever owns the rights to Jetsons is going to watch this movie and be like, hey, we should do the live action movie of this and let's get those sets.
Get Matt Shackman on board for the live action Jetsons, bro. Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if it's too closey, but I feel like, you know, hey, it seems like, you know, Sinners took outfits that would have been for a potential period piece Blade film. So, hey, who's to say that this Jetson live action Jetson movie is like, hey, Marvel, you done with these sets? Like, can we use them? You know what I mean? So it could be something.
Herbie just shows up as a love interest.
Exactly. And they've changed his color and stuff. And it's like, that looks like Herbie. Yeah. But no, it all really came together well to just kind of, again, like we were all saying here, just differentiate itself from the main MCU and also just feel really lived in. It still felt like New York, but just a different New York, mm-hmm. which I think is a plus. That's a massive plus for this. I do want to just kind of shift gears here and maybe talk about some of the CGI in and around, you know, the visual effects overall, but maybe even something around the characters. I'd like to just quickly talk about the look of the Thing, which I think they nailed to a T. The aesthetic, the sort of the roughness and the texture of the rock, it was so well done. And I think it also just showcases this, there's this balance between performance capture and visual effects that it is such a marriage between like it looking authentic. You know, I never, like with his with Ben's or the Thing's visual effects, I never felt like it was done poorly. I don't know about you guys, mm-hmm. if you noticed anything, but I thought like that's like they were definitely wanting to make sure they nailed that properly.
Yes, he was the stitch of the film. When he's a main character, yes. And it's always in his power, you got to nail that look. And I think not only did he nail the look, the fact that when you're having those smaller family moments throughout the movie and he's moving around, you can hear the rock grinding on rock. And just if he's stepping, the weight behind each of his footfalls, like you feel his presence, even if you're not seeing him on it. And this is that's. They nailed the Thing. This is the best version of the Thing we've had to date, for sure.
I love that. I love the stitch of this movie. Like going forward now, the, you know, Toothless was the stitch of that movie. Ben is the stitch of this movie. I love that as an example. I think he's heavy and he has so much weight to him. But at the same time, you kind of get worried about his facial expressions, right? And going into this, I was kind of like, well, you know, Eben Moss-Bacharach from The Bear is so phenomenal in his face acting. And you see it in the performance, and you see it in the performance capture, the way that they utilize his eyebrows, especially to the furrowed part of his head to kind of give you that emotion of whether he's frustrated or, you know, kind of thinking through things or, you know, he is kind of the most perceptive of the bunch of all of them, and that really came through in those visuals. So yeah, no, he was awesome.
Yeah, I love the sounds that they added as he moved, and you're absolutely right, like for the amount of mocap and the lack of facial expression you would imagine a rock figure to have, it was still there, and they used the right elements to give you and connotate those sort of those emotions that he was going through, those feelings. Another CGI'd character, two more, Silver Surfer. I thought Shalabal was done so well. There might have been a couple instances where it might have felt a little too CGI, but in specific moments and scenes, like her introduction, which is in the trailer, floating down and floating in Times Square, they really did pay an attention to detail there and really hone in on that aesthetic. And again, it's that texture that you see on her that kind of feels like it's like, not that it's weathered, but it's like, it's not necessarily as not a clean silver.
There's like a machine
surfer.
Oil to it. It's like, yeah. No, it's not a flat finish. It's a,
because the one in Fantastic Four 2 with the Tim Story series, he was like almost too perfect, right? Like it almost was like, yeah, you're just a CGI character, right? Like there's just a CGI character. So it
looked like a Windows 95 screensaver thing or something.
And they went for a perfect reflective stuff when they hadn't nailed reflections in CG at that time. True. So he always looked out of place no matter how much they tried, because just technology wasn't there yet. So again, they dulling it down for this film was the right thing, because it made it feel more of the world. It didn't feel out of place. Like you're saying, it was part of the world easily. The lighting played well off it, and you got enough of a reflection to still get that silver idea, which, yeah, she was great.
Yeah, especially with a city like New York, right? And her first scene of, we've all seen it if you've seen the trailers of the heralding of it all, like just seeing the light refracting off of her. Yeah, it looked phenomenal. And I think it's one of those things where it's like Silver Surfer, much like the thing, was another sort of point for me where I was like, they have to get this right. And they absolutely did. And I think a big part of that is also due to her movement and the way that she actually sort of, she stays very stiff when she has to, but then when it gets into action mode, she is very fluid. And I think Julia Garner and the way that she was able to utilize her body to be able to kind of sort of showcase how this character moves was fantastic.
Yeah. Watching Silver Surfer surf through a, firestorm or black hole space thing, it was insane. And they nailed the visual effects of that, right? Like it looked really, really good.
It made sense that she's using a surfboard. Like again, right. Surfboard in space doesn't make any sense. It seems very goofy. Then you see it in action and in practice, and you're like, never mind, I'm on board. This makes sense.
Yeah, I'm on board.
So cool.
I was totally on board with it after that. I was
on surfboard. Really, really
cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you for catching us there. Yeah. But yeah, her design was absolutely striking. And I think there's a balance between her looking elegant and eerie all at the same time. And I think they just nailed that. The other counterpart to the Silver Surfer or Shalabal is Galactus, who, in my opinion, like the stuff that they do with Galactus in IMAX is insane. Like you need to see this movie in IMAX just to experience the towering effect that Galactus has in these moments, because they go full IMAX with it. And I was like, I'm here for it. I'm ready for it. So it's nice because there's a eerie stillness to him, and then it's the sound of his voice as well, the way it just shakes your cheeks in the theater and just,
it's what I wanted. That's I told him that's what I wanted, was to exactly. Shake my cheeks. My cheeks were shaking. I think the sound is incredible. And definitely, when we, in look and feel, we should have talked about the sound design in this movie, but I mean, we kind of did with Ben Grimm and everything, but I think with Galactus, my favorite moments, especially in IMAX, are seeing him from the ground level.
Yes.
We do get shots there. There are shots of him, and we do see some of the elements of Ralph Ineson's face, which I don't think is a spoiler to say, but the moments that hit the hardest and that shake the cheeks the most are definitely those moments where we're just seeing an arm smash into a building, a foot stomp on the ground and kick a truck with no thought at all to, no feeling to it at all. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I was fairly impressed with what they were able to achieve with that. I will say, the one thing I was expecting was a little bit more live action, especially for how much they talked about putting him in an actual costume and an actual suit that was designed for this purpose. It did look like when we got some of those close-ups of his face that there was like a lot of CGI. And I think
some CG enhancements, if anything.
For sure.
Right?
But I think that was probably part of the reason why they didn't show him in the marketing material. They haven't shown his face. They haven't, you haven't heard his voice. So, you know, again, he's done well, I think, very accurate to what you would see in the comic books and those crazy Kirby stories. And I love that, you know, it's some of the moments that just felt like they were ripped from a comic book, where it's just like, it's just darkness. And then you see his silhouette and then his eyes light up. Right. And it's just like, that's cool. They gave us something that felt very familiar to the comics in that regard.
Definitely gave Watcher vibes in that moment too, where he's looking down. Right. And I was immediately taken back there. And I do think though, like, he's such a tough character to pull off in so many aspects, let alone the look and feel and the visuals. He is a force of nature. I think for me, I would have been okay. And this is, I mean, Ralph Ineson's voice is incredible. This is no offense to his face, which more so the way that they made it look in this movie. I wish we didn't zoom out as much, just from like a cinematic standpoint. I understand why we had to, but I think visually, he was best looked at from the ground.
Yeah, the perspectives and the angles that they chose to make it seem like he's towering were spot on.
Mm-hmm. And again, those wide angle shots also add to the giving you the scale, and you can see his head towering over skyscrapers in New York. You're like, okay, this man's tall. Like, mm-hmm.
yeah.
And absolutely. That was, and Darcy, that's one of the shots cinematically that does stand out in this movie. I think, you know, there's that, and then like there weren't, for me, I found from a cinematography standpoint, maybe it's just because it was a first watch, and that on a second watch, I'll be able to pick out a few more. That obviously, that moment in the shadow was incredible. Mm-hmm. The foot is incredible. And then I think there's a very specific shot of Sue captured in zero gravity that really stood out to me. Mm-hmm. Just the way that it's framed and lit. But other than that, I think there are some previous Marvel films that had a lot more of those sort of attention to detail when it does come to the shots that I'd be like, I want a painting of that on my wall or what have you. This didn't have as much of it on first watch, but again, I might just not have caught all of it because I was caught up in the adventure.
Yeah. The fantastical elements of it, if you will, some would say.
Yeah.
Michael Giacchino is the composer.
Woo!
Of this film.
Sorry, I have to do that every time somebody says Michael Giacchino.
Yeah. He did a fantastic job. There is such a sense of wonder and sort of dazzle to the sort of theme of the Fantastic Four. But then there's also this really interesting like synth riff for when things kind of get a little weird that I really appreciated. So he lived in the space of retro when scoring this, and there was this lovely choir elements. Obviously, if you've heard the theme song, or it's on Apple Music and Spotify, so you can go hear just that song. You hear all the elements that are there to help just build this presence and this sort of this backbone to who the Fantastic Four is. And I think like so much of what Michael Giacchino does is the music is such a character in these films, and it's no different here with Fantastic Four.
Again, like when they leave like Earth and they go into space, that's when you get those weird synthy vibes that are again meant to instill a feeling of unease, because we're going into the unknown, and it captures that vibe so well. And then again, right back on Earth, when as soon as they get back, you have that chorus that's almost like the Earth is backing this family, and it's so cool to see those two things come together. And just the way he worked his magic through this score was incredible. Kudos to Michael Giacchino once again.
Yeah, I got to attend a virtual press conference for the movie, and Kevin Feige said that Michael Giacchino is the best composer in the industry today. And I absolutely agree with him. The guy's the GOAT. Like, and it has so much to do with his range, right? He's got over hundreds of credits that he's you know, composed for. And mm-hmm. he's got that deep emotional stuff like Up, Inside Out, but then the cosmic adventure stuff with Star Wars and especially Star Trek. And then we factor in the Marvel fanfare itself. And this score kind of brought me to all of those past works in different moments. And I think there's also this very World of Tomorrow from Epcot vibe, which makes sense because in the press conference, Kevin Feige actually said that that Giacchino sent him the theme and just said it's a combination of the score from The Right Stuff and the Disney Electrical Parade. And I was just like, yeah, 100%. And it's cool because it's actually something they played whenever when the crew wasn't necessarily feeling a specific scene, when the cast wasn't feeling a specific scene where they're going off to space.
Yeah.
Matt apparently played the theme for them, and they're just like, oh, we get it. We know what to do. And I think that just speaks to the power of the music of this score and how it fleshes out Earth 828 specifically, and just the themes for this team, this family, these characters. It's something that I look forward to hearing this music again in Doomsday or Secret Wars or what have you.
Sure. It has its own distinct theme that's going to pop. You know what I mean? It's going to, you're going to hear it maybe, mixed in with another score, right? And you did hear that in this. Sometimes you would hear that da, 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 da. You know what I mean? So it was a lot of fun. I also really, you didn't mention it, and I'm so surprised you didn't, but some of the score was giving off mad Lost vibes, man. Like mad Lost vibes.
Sure.
So
yeah, especially the bounciness. There's like a bounciness too as well.
Sure. I was thinking more of like the sort of softer moments, like from the very iconic traditional Lost score where it's like, that's that soft where you just sort of feel these moments. It's more emotional. It's not necessarily
like the piano.
Yeah, like the piano, sure. Like just like little elements like that. So it's not about necessarily taking away from moments. It's about heightening them.
Want to just shout out, there's a song in the credits that just shows how much fun they're willing to have in terms of the music for this movie. It's I won't spoil it, but it was one of those things where we were all like giggling and laughing and smiling at each other, recognizing what the song was actually about. And it's just another way for them to continue to flesh out the world. It's so good.
Awesome. Well, we spent a lot of time talking about just the look and feel of this movie. Now let's spend a lot of time talking about this cast, because
we didn't talk about things we didn't like about the look and feel either.
No, we didn't. I think, yeah, you're right. Like, I think there's just some spotty CGI. I don't necessarily want to talk about where, because it might be a bit of a spoiler. But I'll just say that there were elements in the visual effects that kind of took me out.
Yeah, I think for the most part with this movie, again, aside from some of those really cool Shala Ball, moments that we mentioned, with some of the other characters, and I do think Galactus to a certain degree, it's almost best when they're still or when they're moving slower. It's when they move really quickly or they're thrown through the sky or what have you, where you start to sort of feel that CG-ness of it all. But
it's gonna happen. So all right, let's talk about these performances, because we got four fantastic members for this team. Let's start off with Pedro Pascal, who's just in everything right now. Like, literally, if you go to the movie theaters right now, you can see him either in The Materialist or Eddington or The Fantastic Four First Steps. He's got three movies.
And
in
theaters some right theaters now. In probably some rural place, you could still see him in Gladiator 2. Like, he's...
well, that's last year, that's last year.
But I'm just
saying,
they're still catching up in that,
maybe
somewhere in Ohio.
But you get some new movies. But again, Pedro Pascal brings such range, and he's doing so much. Like, he has such a range with his acting where he can be slightly comedic and charming while also being very introspective and offering more emotional response, right? Like, his character at times is to be his own Tony Stark, is to be the brains. It's interesting to see the parallels of how different a character Reed Richards is to a Tony Stark, but there's already little hints and parallels that find their way. And Pedro made it his own. He made it his own, and he did his own thing with it, and it really did work. I didn't know if I was going to really like the voice, but I liked it. I thought it worked. It grew on me. How about you guys? What do you think of Mr. Fantastic?
I think it just the voice alone kind of helps set up what type of Reed we're going to be getting, which is more the sciencey guy, not sure of himself and very human in that regard. Like, he may have all these powers, but the problems he's dealing with on the inside are very relatable across the board. And just the way Pedro brings that to the character throughout the movie. Again, that he has so much range where he's playing moments comedically right after following it up with something that is very intimate and personal. And it's just, I just love the character and the way he brought him to life on the screen.
Yeah, he's so careful and calculated, but to a fault. And in that way, it humanizes the smartest person in the mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, how do you humanize the smartest person in the world? You cast Pedro Pascal. And I think he's such an incredible character actor, like you're saying. Like, we've seen him as Oberyn Martell in Game of Thrones. I loved him as the Mandalorian. I loved him as Joel in The Last of Us. But watching this in literally 0.5 of a second or whatever, if I'm doing my calculations correctly here, I instantly saw him as Reed Richards, like just pure Reed Richards. And I think every member of the Fantastic Four is so charismatic on their own rights. And I think the movie does such a good job of having you fall in love a little bit with each of them individually, so that when you do get them together, you appreciate that chemistry with these actors even more. And I think my favorite parts of watching this movie with Pedro specifically are the quiet parts where you just look at Reed's face and you just see his like little subtle reactions of like confusion as to like, well, what about this? Don't you get, like, what about this? Don't you understand? Or just those little reactions that he has. I think he is pitch perfect for this character. And I'm so happy with this iteration and portrayal of Reed Richards.
Yeah. It makes sense that he's really leaning into it, and you see why, because there is going to be an importance around his character moving forward. So I think he's really committing to the bit. He's really, he understands the character already, and you see it in his performance. And like I said, he's the brains. And if he's the brains, then Vanessa Kirby as Sue Storm is the heart. She's the emotional anchor of this film. She just radiates such warmth in this film, such strength. And I feel like her arc is very personal. And I think it's something that really does speak volumes of the sort of idea around family. She very much is the anchor to the family.
Yeah, totally. I mean, her performance is incredible. The way that she brought, again, she made these superheroes so relatable. Like, again, the journey she goes on throughout this movie, you see, understand every step of the way why she's making decisions or why she's reacting the way she is. And it's just because her performance is so well. She's nailing the character, except being the heart of this family and keeping everybody in line, or like making sure everybody's heard at times. She's nailing it on every account. And I can't wait to see more of her character going forward.
Yeah, she is the leader of this group. She's so incredibly strong. And I love how this movie showcases that in more ways than one, right? And you talk about the heart, but I also think she's able to work with each of the members of this family like so well. She's instantly quelling worries or stresses or concerns. She's warm, she's caring, but then she has this ability to like step up and take action. And there's this very specific moment where she puts herself in what feels like very clear danger and harm, and it was one of those things where I'm like, what are you doing? Why is she? But then she proceeds to just carry through that sequence with such grace and such poise and such power. Again, like in her words, I was just hanging off of every word in that specific sequence. And I just love, again, how this movie showcases how dynamic Sue Storm can be as a character, her powers, you know, using those powers in different ways than we've kind of seen in the past. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And Vanessa Kirby is just, she's definitely a standout in this cast for sure, amongst standouts, which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of not to sidetrack too much, but in regards to look and feel, and talking about powers, like you said, I think one of the standouts is how they made the Invisible Woman's powers look, the way light refracts to kind mm-hmm. of give shape. And, you know, when she's protecting things or when she's holding things up, what that looks like. It doesn't just look like a stream of a beam that's coming from her. It's like this like light orb of a power. And it really, really worked. Maybe another thing too that didn't work is Johnny Storm, his powers. They looked cool at times. Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they looked a little too CGI, and that was that's okay. I think it's like, it's again, it's one of those things that kind of happens with these films is that some of the visual effects will look spot on, as we've said, and some of it might just look, you know, like they could have cooked a little bit longer with that, you know?
I think, well, speaking of, I mean, that's good, cook a little longer. I think you're kind of nailing it, though, with that unintentional phrase there, in the sense that, like, if it was full flame on, looks fantastic. If it was, like, flame on at the feet, looks fantastic. But when it was maybe, like, half flame on, that's where you really notice that sort of divide between the actor and the fire and the powers and such.
I mean, I found it was very outfit dependent, if you will. Depending on the outfit he's wearing, there were certain ones that it looked better just as a whole.
I would say, though, his face, like Joseph Quinn's face, at times when they did that close-up and the other thing, it reminded me of the comic book from the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know why, but it's just like, you know, like the way the flames were around his head and the sort of color. It was obviously more, you know, obviously more live action and real life, but I feel like that could have been an inspiration to make him look that way.
Mm-hmm. I think it was they were going for that flat thing where the fire wasn't on him. It kind of just was around him and stuff like that. There are times where it looked great. There were other times it didn't. But
for sure,
looks aside, I think Joseph Quinn did a fantastic job of bringing Johnny Storm to life. He nailed the witty, charming personality and also being that little brother to everybody in the group, bugging basically each of them at times, and also just, again, having a whole lot of heart as we go through this movie, the journey he goes on, and he's more than just a pretty face by the end of the movie. And I think the way that they handle these four characters, the focus on the family, is so well done because you get so much from each of these characters throughout the film.
And I love how he's so cool that they don't really have to showcase that, right? Like in the 2005 one, they really had to be like, oh, he's so cool and badass and, you know, whatever. But here, he's just cool because of the way that it's emphasized through visual storytelling. He's on billboards, he's the copper tone boy, or through dialogue and his interactions with, like, especially characters like Ben. Like, I think it's great to see this character that I, at no point in time did I ever feel like, oh, he's kind of a jerk, or he's, you know, like past iterations of him. He's very much this, like, hopeful rock star who is kind of like, I'm kind of done being a rock. It gave me vibes of, like, early Luke Skywalker, if early Luke Skywalker was a badass, you know what I mean? Just that, like, hopeful look to the stars, kind of, and not like a whiny teenager like Luke is. But
again, just being a fan of the comics, this Johnny Storm, I can easily see being best friends with Spider-Man, because again, that is something I'd love to see live action. So and sick. This one would be just great to quip with a Spidey. I think he'd hit the ground running with that.
Yeah, no, I love Joseph Quinn. I think, like, this guy has been on, like, he's been on a rock star career, like, started out in, like, getting real recognition after Stranger Things and being a rock star in that series and being one of the many characters, spoiler alert, that you know, you're introduced to and then dies. And then you have all this heart and you're like, no, why? But yeah, he was a perfect fit for this. You know, I agree with you, Nate. Like, he feels like a Luke Skywalker. He's still young. He's still trying to figure out what he can bring to the team. You know what I mean? He's trying to bring his own energy to it. There is that sort of rock star mentality that I think is so pivotal to who Johnny Storm is, which is why he's such a hothead at times. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think, yeah, he brought it a lot. But it was that chemistry and that spark that he and Evan Moss Bacharach as Ben Grimm, they had such charm together, and it felt supernatural. It didn't feel forced. And that's what was really interesting is, again, scenes between them were far and few. But it was when they were together and it was the two of them, it mattered and it really worked. And I really, really loved that. And I think Evan Moss Bacharach, like you said, Nate, him as Cousin on The Bear is probably one of my favorite portrayals of a character that I've seen on television. I feel like Evan Moss Bacharach did what he could with what was given to him in this, and he made it matter, and he still mattered, but I do feel like we didn't necessarily get a lot of him. He was there, don't get me wrong, but I do feel like he was kind of like, again, like someone that was more background and was more of like just the wisdom. know what I mean? Like there was mm-hmm. there was such wisdom that he offered at times in it, which was nice. But he was a bit like he wasn't as front and center as maybe Reed and Sue and a little bit of Johnny.
Yeah, I think it was cool that he was the calm and collected one in almost every situation. He's a very level-headed guy being like, okay, what's the plan, guys? Let's stop freaking out. This is what we need to do type thing. And again, he just the fact that he did so much through all that mocap and the rock and stuff like that just goes to show how much heart he gives to this character. And then
yeah.
I think the reason why he maybe took a backseat is because his storyline is, again, he can't turn off his powers. And that is something that you need to explore in depth on its own or have him that be more of the focus. So I'm looking forward to future storylines exploring the thing a bit more because what we got in this movie is such a great intro to the ever loving blue eyed thing that he is. So
and I think yeah. that's just it though, Darcy, is like from an expectation standpoint, you watch the trailers, they show the sequence of him looking at the screen, the TV turning off, and just some of those elements where you're like, oh, maybe we're gonna dig into this a little bit more. Yeah. And they set it up, they tee it up, and then then it is kind of like a well, maybe later kind of feeling, which is a lot of what we had in terms of some of the characters in Superman recently as well. And so I got that sort of feeling. But I will say with, you know, you mentioned he did with what he could, like Eben Moss Bacharach did so well that even though that part of his arc was missing, I still fell so head over heels for this character and hopeful for this character. And yeah, his chemistry between him and Joseph Quinn, Johnny Storm, is electric. Like there's just so many moments where they're firing off quips to each other. And I'm like, these guys are just brothers, and at the end of the day they were never mean to each other. They were never like, it never got to the point where they were where I felt like bad for either one of them with the jokes that they were making. I just felt like they loved each other so much that they could make these jokes, and it worked on a like a bare level.
Yes, absolutely. It had a similar touch of like the cousin relationship, right? But just not as vulgar and rude and pissy, right? But there was, again, there was charm there that he, you know, Eben was just, he was so calm, as you said, Darcy, in almost all of his scenes, and yet he brought so much heart. And I think that's why I was like, I mean, we could have had a little bit more of it, but I love this sentiment of like maybe diving in and exploring a little bit more of his character and what's his arc in maybe a future story that can kind of look into how he's dealt with the changes, right? Because mm-hmm. everyone around him still looks like they do, and he's, you know, this big rock thing, and he can't have a sense of a normal life, even though it seems like he is trying to. Again, so much interesting stuff that they planted with him. But the entire dynamic of this four really does help to establish and sell this first family concept, right? Like it's especially in the smaller moments. Like I think this is when they all kind of discover that Sue is pregnant. Like it just, there's this sense of like a family moment that feels very authentic between the four of them. And it's not about like, you know, battles or cosmic reveals or anything like that. It's just a really sincere, heartfelt moment. And I just love that moment where we get to see all of them kind of celebrate and be excited for their future together.
And I mean, that happens fairly early on in the movie, and the fact that it happens so early, and yet I still, to your point, I feel the family love in that moment. I'm just like, it's so palpable, and it just speaks volumes again to the visual effects of how they made, you know, Ben Grimm look, all the way to just the chemistry of these actors.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I've bundled Julia Garner and Ralph Ineson together because I feel like their scenes are kind of tied together, but feel free to jump around. But I thought both of them were absolutely captivating in their role. Both of them had presence. They were very commanding. I will say, and this might be more of a narrative thing, I think their roles were a little bit more establishing for future, more broader cosmic things that could potentially come up. But nonetheless, it was amazing to see these characters come to life in this film. And I think that Julia Garner and Ralph Ineson they were perfect for these characters because both of them act with such presence.
Again, the last Galactus we got being a cloud. This is a vast, vast improvement.
Anything is better than a cloud.
Yeah,
better than
a cloud. That's not. It's not a very good comparison. But I think again, Ralph Ineson and Julia Garner were a perfect pair as the Herald and Devourer. Again, you could feel the presence Julia had when she's coming to Earth and announcing the intent of her master, if you will. And then when Galactus is speaking to the Fantastic Four, and you can feel he's speaking to worms basically, and he, this is so beneath him, but he's giving them the time, and it's just, I don't know, you could feel the presence, you can understand this guy is a galactic being that there has no stop button basically. So how are these guys going to get around it? And you could feel the imminent threat that he posed. I think that was really cool.
We talked about his voice, and I think as well Julia Garner's delivery, everyone's heard it by now with the Herald, his beginning and all that, but I think there's also a really subtle thing that she does with her voice as well in very specific lines where you hear her and you understand, even though she's delivering sort of a message from Galactus, she's sneaking in little things to, you know, like hold your loved ones close. I don't think that's something Galactus would necessarily care for her to say. And when Julia Garner delivers that line, there's a subtle sort of break in her very sort of normal monotone voice. And it happens throughout the movie a bunch of times to help give you this context to her story. And I think it's smart, because when you have a movie that, again, stuff was cut out of this movie so that it wasn't too overstuffed. And so I'm sure there might have been other elements, but for them to be able to, for her to be able to take what was maybe on the page and understand it and deliver it through these lines so that we didn't necessarily have to see everything was really smart and really, really well done. So she was excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I just felt like for the most part, it just feels like these characters were more like seeds. Their performances really just hint at depth, and there's more to explore, but their arcs are sort of intentionally limited here, right? They are just served up as a threat rather than anything else, and I think there's more to explore. So I wonder how else we can expand on these characters. But yeah, their performances were fantastic. Were absolutely fantastic.
Take a drink every time we say fantastic on this one.
Yeah, I've said it too many times. Absolutely.
It's all good. No, you're good.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the story of this film. I think this is probably where it kind of wavers a little bit in terms of, like, again, like I was just saying, I feel like the villains were just villains for the sake of it, especially when you have someone like a Galactus. A Galactus feels like a Thanos, in my opinion. I don't know, like something you build towards, but I get at the same time, like he is like Kirby would just throw him in as like this villain of like cosmic proportions, of like just massive proportions. So I understand that, and that's kind of the kitschiness of having a character like this. But what I really loved is this film, at its heart, it isn't a multiversal story as everyone is kind of been hoping for, or wondering if how it's connecting to the doom of it all, if you will. It's a family story set with multiversal qualities, and I think the film just does a great job of making the relationships feel central and not the powers and plot. Like, those are all there, but it's not necessarily just the focus, right? Even the way they kind of hop over the origin story, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're told the origin, but we're not shown it. It's like it's more about how they've grown to be these heroes and how the world sees them. And I don't know, I just feel like Matt Shackman just brought such a personal touch to it, especially with the experience of, as he was mentioned in an interview that I had with him, which will be coming out later, but he talked about how the experience of being a father really shaped him. And I think that you see that here with, you know, the oncoming of Franklin and, you know, seeing it through Reed and Sue's journey and this idea of just this theme of letting go, you know, of control, of fear, or of this illusion that you can protect everyone and everything. There's this, that is so core to what happens. Like, I have to admit, like, all three of those things I felt when I was, you know, going to be a father, and I still feel at this time, right? Like, there's just so much that you have to let go of, and that you can't necessarily put into. But I like that the pregnancy aspect of this wasn't just a gimmick. It really does ramp up the emotional stakes, and I think it just reframes this sort of cosmic chaos through something that feels very grounded, and this idea of just preparing for new life. You know what I mean? Like, just this idea of being prepared for that. So I think they did really well at keeping a very heartfelt central core to this story that everyone's going to feel they can relate to.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed the story. I think, again, the Galactus being the baddie is just, it is very comic booky, where he would just appear for an issue or two and be that issue's threat. And again, he never, well, he has fought other teams. He has never been that, you know, event ending big baddie. So I think it's really cool the way that he still fits that role in this movie. And there is still a possibility to explore his relationship with Silver Surfer and why he's after Earth and all that in future stories or whatever like that. I think it's really cool. Again, that just flew by. The pacing of this movie is breakneck speed. Like, again, you go over the how they got their powers, everything like that, so quickly, and then you're thrown right into the movie, and then the time just keeps going. But you don't, you're just along for the ride, and it's great. Like, you're not like, oh, slow down a bit, pump the brakes. You're just like, let's go, keep going. This is a page turner. I can't stop reading this comic book. I just can't wait for that next issue. And it was so cool the way that they just kept delivering so many cool moments and scenes that I can almost picture the arc in my head of how I'd be reading it through comics. So it was really cool.
Yeah, I think on the idea of it moving, or like you said, like, it stays balanced, right? It has this very like great balance of action, you know, galactic adventure, but then quiet, emotional, introspective sequences. And to your point, I never felt like I was stuck in one or the other. It yeah. felt like it was just very fluid. And I think my favorite moments are the moments of the family dynamic, the quieter moments, the fun moments. The action is exciting, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't hold a candle to just how phenomenal the chemistry is on screen when these characters are sharing those lovely moments, or even just figuring out what to do next in those sort of frantic sequences. And I think that's where I smiled the most. And I think I think that was the most important thing for this movie to do, is it had to prove to you why you should love these characters, why you should care about them beyond how they fit into the grander MCU. And it had to showcase their strengths as individuals, as well as their greater strengths as a family. But I think as far as the movie falling short, Justin, you mentioned the sort of the elements of Galactus and Silver Surfer kind of feeling more like existential threats than more like personal or sort of complex, like very like sort of rich villains. And I think some people coming into this who are going to want a Thanos level villain, or are going to want even just a deeper, more sort of back and forth between our main heroes and the villain, I think they are going to be a little disappointed in that aspect. But at the same time, I think using the impending end of the world nature of a character like Galactus as an allegory for the birth of a child was a really smart way to get around the shortcomings as a villain and the simpleness of a character like Galactus. I think parents like yourself and anyone who just understands the idea of how a baby coming into someone's life is going to completely, you know, change their entire world. It's not necessarily going to end it, hopefully, but it's going to completely uproot everything that they hold dear. I think they'll find a deeper connection to that side of the story, even if it is sort of shrouded in this like big giant spaceman, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think there is something relatable in this film for families, for everyone and anyone who can relate to this idea of family and what family means. I think that's the core to it. And I think that's what Shackman's done so well, is that's that anchor throughout this film. And yeah, the pacing, it really does work. You know, this film is under 2 hours with post credits, right? With credit scenes and post credit scenes. So it's,
which there are two post credit scenes.
There are two post credit scenes. There's a mid credit and then an end credit, which we won't talk about now. We will save that for a spoiler filled conversation. But yes, it is important to remember that you should stay till the end and watch both. But look, I think that's all we have to say for now about our thoughts on the film. I would love for us to get to our final scores and any final thoughts that we might have, which we are going to be rating out of 1 to 5 Fantastics. Nate, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a little bit of what I've said, but I think overall this movie really worked for me. And again, setting it outside of the main MCU universe was the smartest move that they could have made. Smarter than casting the perfect people to play the Fantastic Four, smarter than bringing in the best composer in the industry to craft the music, and smarter than skipping an origin story that we all already know. It was the smartest move because it allowed me, at least in my experience as a huge Marvel fan, to sit back and enjoy a story that was its own adventure. And, you know, I'm not constantly expecting a cameo from this Avenger or this villain. It just sort of lets you let your guard down when it comes to how goofy and silly those early Jack Kirby stories and early comics in general could get. You then add the themes of becoming new parents and overcoming an obstacle together, not just as a family, not just as a community, but as an entire world. And it just hit me in all the right ways that had me smiling throughout. And I was genuinely worried for this group of characters on screen that it sort of feels like I've just met. Again, the movie you said is under 2 hours. It's like, how much could I fall in love with these characters by the end of that movie? And I really, really did. So despite some minor visual shortcomings and some potential issues that some people might have with a less dynamic villain, I can't say the movie didn't do exactly what it set out to do. And while it doesn't necessarily have me more excited than I already was for Doomsday and Secret Wars, it does have me very excited to see these characters and this family again. So I'm going to give Marvel Studios, the Fantastic Four First Steps, a galactic-sized 4.5 out of 5 Fantastics.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, and I don't want to sound like a broken record or anything like that, so I'll just say this movie does such a great job of bringing Kirby stories to life and bringing the characters are the focus in this story, and it is so nice to see Marvel doing character-driven stories like this again, because it feels like it's been a while since we've had these very true-to-form adaptations where they're just nailing every aspect of the characters in the source material. So yeah, great score, some iffy visuals at times. This movie is a solid, fantastic 4.5. I'm going that way because that just makes more sense in my head. It's a fantastic 4.5.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you both. I feel like the Fantastic Four First Steps it's bold, it's heartfelt, as we've been talking about, and it's a great reintroduction to Marvel's first family. It, as you said, Nate, it kind of bypasses all of that origin story and speeds things up very quickly. And you know, visually, it's a standout. It's brimming with that Jack Kirby inspired flair. It's got that retrofuturistic tone that we talked about, and it just makes Earth 828 feel like its own comic book sandbox outside of the MCU. And I think the cast is just, we talked about it, they're perfectly dialed in. Pedro brings all that intellect and that charm, while Vanessa just delivers so much heart and gravity, and Joseph and Eben just round out with such soul and such spark of fun, and this sort of found family mentality with that is just filled with wit and warmth. And I feel like, you know, we have this, as we talked about, a bit of that traditional villain problem, but you know, they did find the right people to play Shalabal, Julia Garner, and to play Galactus with Ralph Ineson. And they've established something, and I'm excited to see more in the future. But I think where this movie really lands for me is the emotional core. Again, like I was saying before, I think Matt Shakman really just knew how to center this story around the family, pulling from his own experience and just telling a story about self-worth, love, and learning to let go. It's not trying to be the biggest and flashiest MCU film. And I feel like that's very similar to what we had earlier this year with Thunderbolts. It wasn't trying to be this flashy, super off the top, big superhero film. It wanted to stay grounded and focused on characters. And this film is very much like Thunderbolts, is trying to say something real within the sort of superhero comic book genre, and I applaud it. So it might not have reinvented the genre. I feel like it's embracing the genre. It's having fun with it. And like we were saying, it might not get everything right, but yeah, I'm going to be giving this one a solid 4 out of 5. Fantastics.
Fantastic.
Fantastic indeed. Well, that is it for our spoiler-free review for Marvel Studios, The Fantastic Four, First Steps. We are not done talking about this movie, as we kind of alluded to. We do have some interviews that will be coming out later. That includes Nate's interview with Julia Garner and Ralph Ineson, and my interview with director Matt Shakman. So you can find those on podcast feeds and on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/geekcentric. You'll want to make sure you're subscribed both to our podcast and to our YouTube channel so that you can see when those episodes drop. We also are going to do a spoiler filled. Like we said, there are some end credits that we haven't talked about. So stay tuned for that. That'll be coming out once the movie is released. But keep in mind, we also have a ton of other great episodes out now for you to enjoy, like our spoiler-filled discussion for Superman, as well as our spoiler-filled discussion for Jurassic World Rebirth. We also have our spoiler-filled discussion for Marvel Television's Ironheart, all out now on podcast feeds for you to enjoy. We also have a variety of other interviews for you to enjoy, both on our podcast feed and on YouTube at youtube.com/geekcentric, such as Nate's interviews with most of the cast from Foundation Season 3, as well as Nate's interview with the composer of Ironheart, Dara Taylor. She is an absolute delight. That was a great interview. It's a long form, so it's definitely more of a conversation. But other than that, be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure to follow us on our socials. You can find us on Instagram at We Are Geekcentric and on TikTok at We Are Geekcentric. And you can find us on Twitter at GeekcentricYT. Okay, that's it. We are done, boys. Thank you so much for joining me for this spoiler-free review for Fantastic Four. And as we say,
love ya, family.
Laters.
Peace.